Welcome to the Traditional Arts Indiana podcast, featuring interviews with craftspeople and artists from our residency series at the Mathers Museum of World Cultures. I'm your host, Maria Zarang. In this episode, John Kay, Director of Traditional Arts Indiana, speaks with instrument makers Bill Berg and Tony Artis. We hope you enjoy this interview, recorded live at the Lotus World Music and Arts Festival in Bloomington.
Several years ago, we did a project, Traditional Arts Indiana, called Crafting Sound. And it basically sought out to find instrument makers, not just folk instrument makers, but instrument makers from all the different communities that we could find throughout the state. So we identified Iranian santur builders up in Muncie, Irish penny whistle makers in Fort Wayne. We found fiddlers and fiddle makers down in Salem, Indiana, and we just really enjoyed the fact that we work with a real diverse group of instrument makers, and we did an exhibit, and there's even still an online portal called Crafting Sound that you can find out more about instrument makers in the state. That's how I think I really came to know both of these. Well, I knew you from before, but I came to know you, Tony, through Prince Julius Adinyi. Tony Artis is a well-known drummer, well-known in Bloomington, but also farther than that, and also a well-known drum maker. So, Tony, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got started playing the drums?
Okay, well, I'm originally a bass player. I play bass. I'm a jazz bassist. And my wife drugged me to a dance workshop. And, I'm not a dancer, and she is. She's a professor in dance and dance history here at the university. So I go to the workshop, and there was live drumming. And there were only two drummers. And one was playing a djembe, and the other one was playing the dundun. And they were real, I remember their names. It was Khalid Salim and Beverly Botsford. And they were working it. I mean, I'm trying to listen to them and and pick up the dance movements, and the dance was losing out. So at the end, I go up to them and I said, "Look, man, you guys were killing it. How are you? I was hearing, even though there was only two people, I was hearing three rhythms. And I was like, how are y'all doing that?" And he explained to me the concept of resultant patterns, which when you take two different patterns, if the patterns are designed correctly, they'll be put together and make a third pattern. Because I kept hearing this, I said, "I'm hearing three parts. You know, how are you?" And he explained that to me. So I said, "Well, look, man, I gotta start drumming. I don't know what you guys did to me, but I gotta start drumming." So he said, "Well, do you have a drum?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, we'll make one, send it to you." I'm like, "Okay, cool." You know, so I go home and he gave me his information. And I said, "I'll send you something." In the meantime, I'm playing in a jazz group and there's a conga drum player. And I'm telling him, I said, "Man, I went to this workshop, blah, 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 you know." He says, "Well, I got a friend that makes drums in Cincinnati." And I'm like, "Okay, well, I'll do that, you know." And that drum maker that made my first drum ended up becoming my drum making teacher. And so full circle. So anyway, his name is Jubal Harris. He's in Cleveland now. And I spent a week with him, and we made six drums during that week. And that's how I got started. And then I got a grant. That was in 1990. In 1999, I got a grant. I got a Creative Renewal Fellowship, and through that, I was able to purchase all. I was able to go study with Jubal Harris and purchase all my shop material, tools, and everything.
And you've connected with other builders and apprenticed with them, not just here in Indiana, which you can talk some more about, but also in other places. Can you tell us a little bit about that apprenticeship?
Well, the first time I really saw drums being made was in Africa. I had a good fortune of going to Ghana, West Africa. My wife got a residency over there for 6 weeks, so we took the kids out of school and I shut my business down, and we went for 6 weeks. And we stayed in the village of the drum maker that makes the drums for the National Dance Ensemble of Ghana. Her residency was with the National Dance Ensemble. So we stayed in that village, and during that time, I watched them make five drums, four of which I bought. And the fifth drum, the village got together and paid him to give us that drum. So, oh man, it was fantastic. So that was my first time of seeing the drum. I mean, they brought the wood in from the bush. They cut the wood that morning, carved the drum. These guys were master carvers. There was two of them. They tag-teamed the drum. One would carve for an hour or two, and then the other one would watch. And then he would come over and carve. You know, and they'd switch up. And within 5 hours, they had carved a djembe drum. I had never seen it was magic. You know, they took this log and made it into a drum shell in 5 hours. And out of tools that they made themselves. And so right then, I was like, I got to do this, you know, and I didn't know how, and it took me almost 10 years later, well, 7 years later, to finally get a way to do it. And then I'm an architect by trade, and I retired from my architecture in 2000, shut down my practice to do my music full time once I got that grant.
That's great. That's great. Let's bring Bill Berg into this conversation. Now, I've been knowing you, Bill, for probably close to 30 years. Yeah, I actually worked for Bill in his little shop right out of high school, Mountain Made Music in Nashville, Indiana. And I was talking to him before the thing. Bill very well could be the most prolific builder, having built more musical instruments than anybody else I know of in the state. Tell us how many you think you maybe have made.
I think I have about 150 to 200 a year. So, you know, constantly doing it, you know, day in, day out.
So you build dulcimers, but you didn't necessarily start with dulcimers. Tell us a little bit about your introduction to music and your apprenticeship that you went through, and then also where the dulcimer thing came from.
Hey, originally I worked under a violin maker in the Chicago area, and mostly what I did was repair work for large schools and such. And it was a company called Carnes Music Company. They did a lot of rentals. So I worked in the violin shop, and the violin maker that I worked under came from Mittenwald, Germany. And a fairly young guy at the time. He was in his, like, 30s. Then I did that for about 3 or 4 years, and then started making some instruments on my own, some mandolins, a few guitars, and dulcimers. And I started working through the Renaissance festivals. And that's where I really figured out that, yes, this can be done. You know, this you can actually make a living on this. And really what sold well there, this is like in the early 70s. This is when Joni Mitchell was around, not sure, and playing the dulcimer and everything. So it was kind of like an instrument. And, you know, I kind of dropped the other instruments and just made mainly mountain dulcimers and eventually hammer dulcimers. Yep.
That's great. Could you, I'm going to ask Tony to do this too, but could you maybe play us a little something so people can hear what a dulcimer sounds like? Beautiful. Let's get Tony to do the same thing. Play. I don't think I'm going to have to hold the mic as close for you.
No,
but maybe you can play us a little something. And that was Wildwood Flower that you were playing there. A good old American fiddle tune, I guess. What are you going to play for us?
I'm going to create something. I'm going to create something here and just make it up.
Okay.
Let's see. Usually we do an intro, a middle, and an end. Thank you.
That is great. That is great. Ken, always when I have people that make things and we're having a conversation with them, I always like to ask them to give us the walking tour. You know, show us what the instrument is. How was it made? Where did the materials come from? When someone looks at that, it's easy for them to just go, oh, he's got a drum, but they don't ever really look. And so I want you to, as a builder, tell us what we should be seeing when we look at this drum.
Okay, well, it's basically wooden skin and rope, a little bit of metal. But you have the basic parts of the drum is the drum head, the parts that you play. It's usually made of animal skin. A lot of them are plastic nowadays, though. But traditionally, it's made of animal skin. This one is made out of cow skin. Goat skin is another popular skin that's used. Goat skin is thinner than cow skin, so goat skin is usually used on the higher pitch drums, and the cow skin is used on the lower pitch drums. The body of the drum is made out of wood. Traditionally, the bodies were carved from solid logs, but since solid logs are kind of hard to come by, unless you're going to go out and cut them yourself. The slat drum was brought into being. There are 19 pieces of wood in this drum. Each one is cut like this. You notice this piece is cut wider at the top and smaller at the bottom. Also, if you look at the end of it, the ends are not cut square. They're cut at an angle. And that bevel, based on the angle, the number of degrees in the angle will determine the circumference of the circle. So, since this was wider at the top, smaller at the bottom, it's going to have a smaller circle, wider circle. Now, you take these, and you'll take one like this, put it upside down, lay a bead of glue down it like that. Take another one, put it up there, join it real good, and then take a staple gun and join the two top edges, and you work your way around the drum like that. Once you do that, there's a series of steel rings that you use, and I have a machine at home. It's a hand crank machine that makes circles out of straight steel bar. I buy straight steel bar, and then then I'll make a series of rings. Turn the drum upside down because it's sitting like this on the floor. I'll make a series of rings, one here, 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 and here. I'll take a mallet and a piece of wood and drive those rings down tight over that so it squeezes the pieces of wood together so tight that you can't get anything between them. So I let that set for 24 hours and dry. This is a smaller version of it. Once it's dry, I'll plane it down, sand it down, make it nice. You can say, look, that this pretty much looks like a solid piece of wood because the joints are so squeezed so tightly together that you can't hardly see them. Okay, so once I do that, then I'll make the rings. The rings are three rings to the system. The rings combine with the rope to stretch the skin over the top of the drum. Naturally, the tighter you stretch the skin, the higher the drum is going to sound. So there are three rings. There's a ring here at the bottom. There's two rings. There's one inside the skin, and then there's another one on top. The top and the bottom rings have a series of rope. They call it the cradle. And the cradle is a series of loops that are put on the rope, on the ring. And you run the verticals between those loops. Then you put the skin on, you put the ring in the other skin, in the other, the only skin, excuse me, and then put it on top. Then you stretch the skin. You have to work the skin to get it nice and even all around. And there should be excess to the skin around here that you can grab a hold to. Once you get it on the drum like you like it, then you trim it. Once you get the drum, the skin nice and evenly stretched on the body, then you trim it and you let it set for anywhere from 3 to 7 days. It depends on what time of year it is. If it's in the summer, I can sit it out in the sun and let it dry. It'll dry within 2 to 3 days. But if it's in the wintertime, I can't take it outside, so I have to put an electric heater on the floor and lay the drum on the floor, and it takes a lot longer. Okay, so once the head is dry, then you can pull the skin and tune it. You can tell the drum is tuned properly, but each one of the verticals is tuned. So each one should have the same pitch. That's how you can tell if there's even tension all the way around. Once you do that, and you may have to work your way around the drum anywhere from 4 to 6 times, because unlike a trap set drum where you tune one side and then you go and tune the other to have the tension even, you can't do that on this. So you have to gradually work your way around, because if you pull too hard on one side, it's going to make the ring go crooked. And so it takes a while. So once you do that and everything dries, you got your drum. And also, a lot of times I'll stain the wood and also do carving on it. Depends on, you know, what the order is.
That's great. Now, what type of drum would this be called?
This is called an ashiko. Well, depends on where you go in Africa as to where what it'll be called. There's over 1,000 dialects and languages spoken in Africa. So even right within Nigeria, the ashiko is a Yoruba name. But if you go, the Igbos call it akuba. Mm-hmm. So it's just, you know, depends on who you talk to is what it's called.
That's great. Let's bring Bill back in on the conversation here. Why don't you give us a little bit of the walking tour, you might say, of your dulcimers? Maybe you even want to hold up one that's not all glued up and looking pretty. Even in pieces, it looks pretty nice, though.
Yeah. I start with just rough sawn wood, and I have a lot of machinery in the shop. I have what's called a resaw machine, which is a big bandsaw with a 3-inch blade on it, carbide tipped, and that allows me to cut the wood into thin slices. And these are what's called book matched wood. It's basically you take a board and you slice it in a little over 1/8-inch pieces, and then so this side and this side are out of the same board and book matched, like you kind of consider it like opening up a book, but it's a board. Then I'll start out, I'll make a lot of parts before I start assembling. Like I might make 50 fingerboards like that in different variety. And then I'll select maybe 10 of those and start a group. And that group could take as long as like 3 weeks or as short as say 15 days, depending on how complex the instrument is. This is one of my most expensive and more complex instruments, so this would take the longest. Let's see, what else here? Yeah, the fingerboards are really what make or break any string fretted instrument. And the placement of these little metal pieces here have to be exact, or else you don't have an instrument. It just doesn't have any sound at all, or it won't play notes correctly.
Well, looking at the instruments that you brought here, some of you that know dulcimers may know of like Gene Ritchie or that type of thing, or have seen these are not a Gene Ritchie dulcimer. These are not old-timey type instruments. Tell us about that.
These are, one thing, this is basically my own design, and the original dulcimers were made in the Appalachian Mountains and actually comes from an instrument called the Schiholt, which is German and more just rectangular-shaped. And the history that I accept about this is that the Germans who brought the Schiholt to the Appalachian Mountains, the Scotch-Irish who were living there picked that up and started playing fiddle tunes on it. But it still, the instrument is basically the same. It's fretted to the scale. Fretted, so this plays do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. And if you happen to see the guitar maker, guitars have frets in between all those frets, so you play sharps and flats. This just plays the whole notes.
And where do you get your woods, and what type of woods do you use?
A lot of domestic woods, cherry, like this is cherry, and the one on the floor there is walnut. Actually, interesting thing, the back of that one was from an old door from a church. And it was a door, a friend of mine does reconstruction on old buildings and such. So he was working on this church, and the door had a lot of wormholes in it, whatever. But it had enough good wood that I could cut it up and make an instrument out of it. And then I also just buy wood locally. There's a specialty wood place up in Chicago that I go to for like rosewood and that sort of thing. But anywhere I can find it. And,
That's great. One of the other things about your instruments that have been kind of distinctive, and I've played one of your instruments for many years, and I have a recessed fingerboard, and that's kind of totally That's totally from your head, just a little bit, right? Tell us a little bit of that, the history of that,
actually,
you might say.
I lived in Chicago area, and I used to go to the Natural History Museum there. And there was a display of old, it must have been just a display of 1850s history. And there was a banjo in there that had a kind of recessed fingerboard. Never seen another one since. I said, well, that's, you know, neat. So I decided to try using it. And that's where I got that from. But what it does is allows you to give like a kind of a sitar effect, kind of this bending sound. It also makes kind of the, what's called the action, the playability of the instrument a little bit faster.
A lot lighter touch.
Lighter touch. And you can just see how, you know, you just have to press anywhere between those frets and you're going to be putting pressure on the fret, which is, and that's where the sound comes from.
One of the things, too, as you turn that in your hand, I notice it's hollowed underneath there. Why is that?
Really, if it was solid, you wouldn't get half the sound out of the instrument because it's about a little less than a quarter of an inch all the way around, basically. And that just allows the wood to vibrate a lot better. Yep.
Okay. That's great. Well, we'll come back because I want to ask both of you another question about who you built. I mean, you would think that dulcimers is kind of a special market. I would imagine drums are definitely a special market. Tell us who you built, who your community is. Who do you play with, and also who do you build for?
The community I play for is pretty widespread. The drum has become very popular, you know, and I think it's part of it is because the drum was probably considered one of the first instruments, you know, ever other than the human body, and there's a lot more popularity, especially the djembe drum right now, which is real ironic because that's one of the most difficult drums to play, but everybody seems to gravitate toward it, but. So I do a lot of work in the schools. We do a lot of festivals like this. And that's pretty much it, schools and festivals.
But you've got some bands, that you know, ensemble groups you play with. Tell us about those.
Well, we have a Sancocho Music and Dance Collage. It's basically my family and my son and my wife and another good friend of ours. Originally, it was we started in 1995, and we do music from the Caribbean islands, but we focus on the islands that are Spanish-speaking and have strong African retentions, because each of the Caribbean islands are a very unique mix, you know, based on who was there originally, who colonized it, who was brought there after the colonization, all that. So it's a very unique mix of all these elements. So we focus on the Spanish-speaking and strong African retentions.
That's great. And you mentioned that you taught your son to play. How's he coming along?
Well, my son, I started him out when he was 7 years old. He is now my teacher. I'm slightly prejudiced, you know, but he has turned into a monster on the drum. I mean, he just took off. And plus, we took him all over the world. Every time we went somewhere, we took him and his sister, you know, and they drank all that in, and he's just... He's a great drummer. I'm proud to say that he's my son, and I'm proud to say that he's become my teacher.
That's fantastic. We're going to ask the same questions of Bill here, but also be thinking about what questions you have, because after I ask this, I'm going to turn it to you all and see if you have some questions for our builders here. Bill, who do you build for? Who do you play music with? What's your community?
Actually, I play with a little band called the Clodhoppers, but I don't play the dulcimer to that. Actually, when I play with that group, it's a three-piece group, harmonica player, singer-songwriter, and I'll play acoustic lap steel, mandolin, and guitar.
And where'd that acoustic lap steel come from?
You know, actually, the history, that was the Dupira brothers first made that. And if you ever see one, they have a big metal plate in the center of them, which is, that's where the sound comes from. And it amplifies and kind of gives us this kind of bright sound. And I think they were German originally.
Last time I saw what you were playing, there was one that you made. You were playing a lap instrument.
Yeah, actually, I do have. I've been kind of experimenting with making solid wood lap steels. Actually, the history behind that is that when you had brass bands, particularly in the 20s and 30s, the guitar player could hardly be heard. So they made this instrument to be a loud enough instrument so he could hear it over the brass instruments. So, yep.
Well, tell us a little bit about who you build for, too. We were having a kind of an interesting conversation this morning about you build for pretty much the same people you've always built for.
Actually, I was telling a story about I was in the car with one of my son's girlfriends, and she was asking about that question, who I built for. And I said, well, when I started out in the 70s, it was all these like young women who wanted to be like Joni Mitchell. And now it seems like they're all little old church ladies. Then I started thinking about it. You know, Joni Mitchell is probably qualified to be a little old church lady at this point. But it's, I do sell to, oddly enough, it's become a very popular instrument in a lot of churches. I sell, right now I'm in a strictly internet business, so I really sell all over. In the 80s, I did a lot of craft fairs, large festivals, and I actually stay out on the road about 3 months out of the year doing those. Then I had a music store, and now I'm doing just strictly internet. Yep.
And if someone's looking for an instrument, what should they be looking for?
The playability, actually what I was saying before, it's a lot of it is just about the fretboard. If that fretboard is not right, it's not going to sound right. So there's certain things you can do with a dulcimer, and this is would be true with a guitar too. There's a if you just touch the string on the middle fret, or this is halfway between this place and this place, and press down, that should be exactly the same note. If that's off, if sharp or flat, it's never going to play right. And then just see how it sounds to you. If that sounds right, then you got a decent instrument.
That's great. How about you, Tony? What should someone look for in a drum?
You want to make sure that the skin is nice and even. You can hold, if you can hold it up to a light, and look at this at the skin to make sure that there's no thin spots in the skin, because that will result in the skin breaking on you later on. Especially look around the rim to make sure that there's no thin spots there. You want to make sure that good quality materials are used. The skin is a uniform thickness. You want to check the rope, make sure the rope is stretched uniformly, and also the type of wood that's used, because there's many different variables. The type of skin that's used, the type of wood that's used, determines the sound of the drum. So and then if it plays very easily, if you can hit it with one finger and get a nice sound, if you have to work and you're still not getting a good sound, and you want it to play very easily.
Okay, let's see if there are any questions we have in the audience. Something you want to ask? Right here. Okay, I'm going to repeat that because we're recording this as well, but so people get in the back in here. The question is, what types of woods do you use, and for what instruments, and some detail there.
Depends on the type of drum. If you're using a drum that is on the higher pitch end of the spectrum, you want to use harder woods. For the lower end, you want to use softer woods because they have a more mellow sound. So a lot of my drums are just made out of white pine. You know, for the djembes and stuff are usually carved. Most of them are carved out of African woods, but they're very hard woods, and which makes them harder to work with too. You end up having to sharpen your tools a lot and all that. But I prefer the hardest woods I've worked with have been like walnut, and a lot of your congas and bongos are made out of white oak.
What other questions do we have from the audience? Yes, back there. Yeah, there's a threat with the emerald ash borer. Is ash something that you can use for drums or dulcimers?
For the fingerboards a lot. Ash is a very good wood for that. It's a very stable. Yeah.
Real straight grain, real stable, real even.
I haven't used ash a lot. You know, I use some of the more common woods, like I said, like pine, and I've even used birch. Something stuff like that, but it's just a matter of sometimes people come and they'll want to specify, you know, what type of wood they like. I've made them out of walnut, stuff like that, I've sold drums as far away as New Orleans thanks to the internet. And so.
Where do you get most of your wood, though?
Lowe's.
That's probably why you're not getting ash, I would imagine.
No, but there's another place called Northwest Lumber in Indianapolis, and they have all kind of exotic woods. I mean, they've got some African woods there. Yeah.
What other questions do we have? Anyone? We've been pretty thorough here. I think I'll ask one more little round of questions if there's no other ones here. One is both of these are very traditional instruments, and the idea of tradition is something that's come from the past and continues to be relevant in a variety of ways today. What's the future for these instruments, do you think, for both the drums and the dulcimers? Where's this going to? Is it something that's going to be waning now, or is it something, do you see there being a future in it? Who are you teaching to do this, take up the business?
As I say, actually, most of the people I'm selling to right now are my age. Every once in a while, I'll sell to a younger musician, and I remember with this one guy, he was in a rock band. You know, he was going to play rock and roll on it. It's actually one of the things, there is a lot of interest in acoustic music now. I'm trying to dig up some of the names, but there are some actually, you know, people on the radio who are, you know, playing kind of modern folk music.
And Mumford and Son.
Mumford and Son, that's what I was thinking of. And I could see them picking this up, or Alison Krauss or something like that, you know.
We were talking about Bruce Hornsby actually has an album with.
Yeah, that shocked me. I was turning on the TV set, and here's Bruce Hornsby on The Tonight Show playing the dulcimer. How did this work? I don't know.
So you apprenticed to learn how to do this. Do you think someone will, have you apprenticed someone to take over this work?
Not in the work so far, so it's. Nope. Just me all alone in the shop. It's a.
And the dogs, yeah. Shop dogs. Let's ask you the same thing. This is something you've picked up and you've amassed a lifetime of knowledge. Have you passed this on to anyone in your family or your community?
Well, my son's picking it up finally. You know, I've been trying to get him to get interested in. Once he started blossoming as a drummer, I told him, well, you know, in the African tradition, you're not considered a master musician unless you can make your own instrument. So, you know, even to maintain and put your head on, you know, you can pay somebody to do it, but there's nothing like being able to put it on yourself and get it exactly like you like it, you know? So he's picked that up. And then a lot of the kids that we make, I do some workshops where we make a little frame drum. It's just a frame, like wooden frame out of a picture, like a picture frame. And we use plastic packing tape, stretch it around it. That sparks some interest, and then but it's more than most people are willing to handle, you know. I've been trying to preach it in the schools because you can pick up so many different skills. You got to work with metal, you got to learn welding, you've got to learn macrame, you've got to learn leathercraft, and you've got to learn carpentry. A lot of people are interested in one, but not all of them, you know. It's not for everyone, but all we need is a few good people to pick it up, and ladies too, because you know, not just because a lot of times they think it's just for men, especially the drum, not necessarily.
Well, we got a question back in the back again. A duet that'd be really great. You're kind of a rockin' dulcimer player here, so I think that would.
Trying to figure out something with enough rhythm to it.
Bill Berg and Tony Artis. That's probably the first Dulcimer duet you've done here.
We have to do more. We might have a CD working here.
Let's thank again our instrument makers for being here with us today. Bill Berg and Tony Artis. They've done just really beautiful work. I want to thank you for coming to Lotus in the Park, and I want to thank you for coming especially to our programs today here at the IU Global Education Pavilion. So thank you.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you have enjoyed this podcast, and we'll tune in for our upcoming interviews with Indiana artisans. This podcast would not be possible without the support of the National Endowment for the Arts, the Indiana Arts Commission, and Indiana University's Themester Program.